Hi, welcome back to AR Zone. I'm your host, Carolyn Bailey. These continuing interviews on anti-oppression, veganism and related issues are in association with VegFest UK. In this new series of AR Zone interviews, we're very excited to begin the series with our special guest for today, Trent Grassian. Trent is a full-time researcher who has spent over a decade working in the fields of anti-racism, LGBTQIA+ liberation, disability rights, and animal advocacy. He recently completed a PhD in social policy examining vegan, vegetarian, and even reducitarian transitioners participating in UK-based campaigns entitled A New Way of Eating, Creating Meat Reducers, Vegetarians, and Vegans. He also helps run London Vegan Voices. Trent is joining us today to discuss his research, what we have to look forward to at VegFest this year, and his work in general. Trent, welcome to AR Zone.
Thanks very much, Carolyn. Glad to be here.
You're very welcome. Trent, as I mentioned in your introduction, you've recently completed a study which draws on the experiences of vegans, vegetarians, and reducitarians, exploring the central importance of socioeconomic barriers in transitioning to a plant-based diet. You'll be addressing this research at VegFest UK events this year. Would you please tell our listeners what the goal of that research was and why it was so important?
Yeah, so when I started my PhD, I was really interested in the policy side of things. I mean, I still am. You know, I see that as such an important way for us to change the food system and support, people going vegan and support more sustainable ways of living. But through that, I did a lot of interviews with EU folks and, you know, kind of leaders in the area and did a lot of reading. And I really recognized, as others have, that, you know, we're unlikely to see significant policy changes in the current climate. People just don't want to tackle consumption in that way. So, you know, as someone who's passionate about, you know, the nonprofit sector, the third sector, I was really interested in working directly with campaigns and seeing that as the way that, you know, future policy will change, because it's the way that we're getting people on board with the message, getting them to realize, hey, this is not just like this weird fad thing. This is actually something we should all be doing. So through that, I reached out to something like 50 different organizations, trying to understand, you know, what types of campaigns were going on and working with them in terms of their research priorities. So what really became clear to me is that, you know, there are a lot of organizations often with very limited budgets, you know, limited staff, limited resources, trying to do this really difficult thing of helping someone, you know, change their lifestyle in a way that may feel really significant for them, and changing individuals in something that is really intrinsically social and cultural and steeped in all these norms. So I wanted to help understand what's happening with these campaigns and the people who are changing their diet. So I ended up working with 7 different campaigns, and I followed the participants in the campaigns over a 6-month period using surveys and looking at their dietary goals, their dietary habits, their perceived barriers to dietary change, and their motivations for changing. So through that and doing focus groups with the same people and also interviews with the staff, I was really able to look kind of more comprehensively at this process. What's going on here? You know, I really see it as a journey that these people are undertaking and what's happening on the journey, because we know so little about it. And within our movement, there are so many, you know, self-proclaimed thought leaders out there telling us things that aren't necessarily based in any evidence, but are just anecdotal. So trying to really get some evidence for this and look at the trends in a mixed methods way that would really not just give us some data, but give us kind of that depth of what are these experiences people are going through. So the goal has very much been to support nonprofits and support advocates, activists, and as well as those, you know, in the policy arena, to kind of understand what dietary change looks like and how we can get people to move in this direction and what kind of supports they need.
Thanks, Trent. I think it's absolutely fascinating, the parts of the research that I've read so far. Part of it concluded that vegan goals and campaigns were more successful at promoting greater and sustained reductions in terms of eating other animals. Here in AR Zone, we've been warning about the problematic nature of vegans promoting reducitarianism for many years, because we believe that promoting veganism is more likely to lead to a reduction in animal consumption anyway. And your research seems to support that. Would you please elaborate on what you found in regard to this area of your research?
Yeah, definitely. It's one of those things where as soon as I started, so many people started asking me about it. And I was like, I never saw that as a focus, but it ended up really coming out in the research quite clearly in a way I didn't expect personally. I found it just surprisingly, I guess, clear in the data how these stricter goals were much more likely to be met. It was really interesting. I always present this data really hesitantly because I think it's important to recognize that the nature of my sample being these people who participate in campaigns isn't necessarily, like an unbiased sample in that way. So there's a lot of elements that can go on here. And ideally, we really need some future research that uses randomized controlled trials, etc. But that aside, within this, it's really interesting to see that, as I said, the stricter goals are more likely to be met. So vegans were actually twice as likely to meet their goals, rather planned vegans, than those planning to eat less meat. Those planning to eat less meat, only about 39% were meeting their reduction goals at 6 months. Only 47% were actually eating less meat. Whereas those trying to go vegan, 78% were successfully meeting that goal 6 months later. So, it suggests many different things, and I think there's other elements to this that I could go into. But one thing I think we need to really think about is a lot of times we conflate, and Casey Taft talks about this brilliantly, we conflate the idea that just because people are more likely to do something doesn't mean that's what we should be telling them to do. So, it's really easy to tell me not to eat dessert once a week or something, hypothetically. But if I want to be healthier, that's not necessarily what you should be telling me, because then I think, oh, well, 6 days a week, I can eat a big slice of chocolate cake, and that's apparently fine. So it's the same exact thing here. And it makes sense, really, when we look at the way that habits are formed, and it's really the idea of practicing veganism, as I see, is very important. Because when you leave these old habits in place, it's easy to fall back on them. And I think for reducers in particular, there isn't this clear goal, right? When you tell someone, you should eat less meat, it's not necessarily clear what that looks like. It's much harder to actually monitor if you're eating less meat. And I think that's something a lot of us have wondered, and I wondered going into this. How do you actually know if you're eating less meat? And what does that look like? So one thing I've been saying is that clearly we need to think more critically about this, and we need to stop thinking that the default should be a reduction goal, not just because ethically on every level that isn't enough, for the animals, for every reason we need to be promoting veganism, because actually if we ask for something that isn't clear and is perhaps much easier to do, like a Meatless Mondays type idea where you're only not eating meat once a week, you're unlikely to see as much change as you would otherwise. So one thing that I think, though, is that I still think there is this role for a kind of stepped approach is something I talk about. I think we need to still have that vegan goal in mind and not using that messaging of reducing is enough. I think that's a mistake, especially when it's not even clear what that means or why it would be enough. I think what we need to do, though, is there are these people that I found in my research and others, similarly would find them as well, who are very resistant to an idea of vegetarianism or veganism. And for those people, you can't necessarily just go up to them and say, hey, you should go vegan right now and think that that will work. But there are ways that you can move them toward the direction of accepting veganism. I think that should always be our goal. How can we keep moving them forward? Not, oh, they've reduced a bit, we're done. It's getting them more used to habits, getting them more motivated. There's a lot of different ways. And I think for different people, different strategies are really needed to increase their motivation and make them likely to change their habits.
Yeah, I agree with what you've just said. I think certainly with different people, there are certainly lots and lots of different approaches that are available to us. You also mentioned that what does it even mean to reduce? That's something that's always, I guess, bothered me. What if I go to McDonald's and have one Big Mac instead of two Big Macs? am I a reducitarian? I don't know really what it means. And it doesn't cover things like other animals who are used for entertainment or clothing, experimentation, things as well. So, yeah, I just wanted to, I guess, confirm that I agree that I don't know what it means to be reducitarian, and I don't know how that type of person sets their goals. I wanted to ask you about goals, which you've already touched on, and you've mentioned that people are more likely to reduce when given a clear vegan message rather than a reducitarian one, and are also more likely to reduce when they set themselves clear goals, like to live vegan, for example, rather than really vague goals, such as to reduce their part in animal exploitation. I guess I want to ask you why it's so important to have more solid goals.
In my research, I work with a variety of different theoretical models. I'm much more practice-oriented and looking at, I think I'm more interested in like practical research than the theory. But if we look at theory, if we look at behavior change theory, it always includes a goal component, you know, and this just makes sense. It's just rational that you need something you're trying to achieve. Because I think with reduction, it implies that it's something you'd have to monitor on a daily basis. It sounds exhausting. You know, do you have to weigh the amount of meat you eat? And like you said, it often doesn't include other animal products, even in diet or other elements of your lifestyle, of course. And I think it's less, I think with the reduction message, you're promoting the idea that some amount is still okay, or that some level of reduction is enough. So I think when we make a clear goal, you know, and like I said, Casey Taff, I think, is the first one to really, in his book, talk about this in a way that's very clear. But that if we present a clear goal, people are more likely to get closer to that goal, right? And then they have an idea of what they're reaching toward. You know, I can say, you know, like with fitness, I think is always a great example where you can look at people who are in excellent shape, they exercise all the time, and you can think, I would love to reach toward that goal. And in this case, it may be unattainable, but why would you think, you know, oh, I'll just go to the gym once every 6 months, and maybe that's enough. You know, I just have to go to the gym sometimes, and then it counts, which is, I think, how this is. Yeah, it's like, oh, I ate a vegan meal once this week, or a vegetarian meal. But, yeah, so I think that's where we need a lot of clarity, right? And we need a much clearer idea, not just of what you're saying when you're reducing, but it needs to be less about, I think, you know, it should be less about the times when you're eating vegan and more about when you're not, right? So it's like, okay, how am I increasing the number of vegan meals and days I'm having? So, you know, I think for some people that can really start in a really simple way. And I think we kind of need to accept that for some people, especially like, for instance, I'm from the US, I live in the UK, and in the UK there's this idea of meat and two veg as a meal. And that's really ingrained in people, right? So for someone who is really accustomed to a certain way of eating, the idea of a meal not having meat can be very scary. And it can be like, you know, I'm not going to feel full. It's going to taste terrible. I'm not necessarily going to get all the nutrients I need. Or on the other side, it's way too healthy. It's ridiculous. So getting them just used to the idea of a vegan meal can be a huge first step there for those people. You know, for people who are more into cooking or more adventurous, that's probably not as necessary. But for those individuals, that can be a really big first step in getting them through there. And getting them, you know, I think there's a lot of ways that, like, we can bring in the social element. So having shared meals where you're experiencing this and you're with people. And in those contexts, you can increase your motivation by learning more. Yeah. So I think there, you know, there's all these different ways that we can still keep a vegan goal in mind and try a bunch of different strategies that don't always look like, you know, just telling everyone, why aren't you going vegan a second? And can be a bit more forgiving of recognizing that with some people, if you do that, it's not probably going to get them to do anything, but we can still move them toward that. And hopefully, you know, in a way that isn't going to take forever.
Absolutely. Thanks, Trent.
So, hi, Trent. This is Roger here. As a relief to Carolyn's outrageously long questions, I'm going to ask you a short one. Can you explain the notion of the meat reducer typology, please?
Yeah. So when I was, looking through my data, it was, this question of what are meat reducers doing kept coming up. And I found I was analyzing the data in so many different ways and trying to make sense of the meat reducers because there were a lot of different things going on. And I was trying to think, what are the trends that I'm actually seeing? And what I found is that it really seemed that there were three directions that meat reducers could go in. So there were some things happening with meat reducers that were positive. One of those is that over time, they seemed to be more likely to not report eating meat and be more likely to report a plan to become pescatarian, vegetarian, or vegan. So this suggests that for some people, starting in a meat reduction direction could lead them to then, learn more, become more motivated, be more comfortable with the diet, and eventually want to move toward a vegan diet. The problem is, this number increased over time, but after 6 months, it was about 9% of the sample. A much larger group was what I referred to as temporary reducers. So it seems that in every group, they had large reductions in the first month, and then those often became less or disappeared. So after a month, you were more likely to actually increase, if that makes sense. Not necessarily the point you were at 0 months, but to start increasing again. So this suggests that for reduction, I really saw that it seems to happen in waves, right? So there were people who I referred to as non-reducers who weren't saying that they were actively reducing. And many of them, I believe, were former reducers, right? So, and then many reducers became non-reducers. So it's like you cycle in and out of reduction, and it's very temporal in nature. And that was about 65% of the meat reducers who, at 6 months, were either not eating less or were saying, oh, I'm not going to be eating less in the next 6 months. And then there was a smaller group that was about 26% of long-term reducers. So these are the people who have successfully managed to reduce and are maintaining that into 6 months. And I met some of those people in my focus groups, and there are ways that they could make this work in their lives. And that would be a great group to then, of course, give other goals to, right? And encourage them. If they're doing well here, why not encourage them to reduce even more, to go vegetarian, go pescatarian, and eventually go vegan? But yeah, so what this suggests is that, like I said, that it seems that just because people are willing to reduce doesn't mean they're necessarily going to be successful in doing that. There's a lot of elements going on here. But I think it's something that I would love to see future research into. Like I said, a randomized control trial would be ideal. I think that's what we really need to do to see how diet change is happening. When we present people with different goals or when people have different goals, what actually happens over time, and looking at more samples and wider groups of people to understand more about that process. And what we can do to move people, I think, especially this long-term reducers, move them toward the direction of a more vegan goal. And these temporary reducers, how do we get them to sustain those reductions? What does that mean? Maybe we need a clearer goal for them that has a higher level of reduction where they understand that the real goal is veganism, but for now they're going to try to reduce a lot more.
Yeah, that's really kind of interesting, the way that kind of people move along, as it were. You said earlier that Casey Taft has said that just because people are more likely to want to reduce, that doesn't mean that we should, that's what we should be promoting, right? Do you think that your findings thus far are supportive of the fairly common understanding, I think, at least in the grassroots movement, that people move incrementally, but that a clear understanding of the end goal, i.e., understanding the ethics of animal use, for example, is not a bad thing, which often the reducitarians say, but actually is a good thing?
Yeah, no, I mean, I completely agree. I think I definitely found that reductions seem to be gradual. I identified something referred to as the reduction hierarchy. So people were much more likely to plan to reduce red meat, then white meat, then dairy, and fish and eggs were last. What I really found was that it was kind of like this gradual process. And what was really fascinating, and I didn't expect, is in focus groups, there were times that I had people who were meat reducers. So they were still eating meat, but they actually seemed to express a real desire to be vegan one day. They'd say things like, we're not vegan yet, or, really sympathize with the ethics there. And it, you know, I think this, like I said, this isn't just a random sample, but within this sample, there were very, very few people who I would have said I would be concerned if we tell them, you know, you need to go vegan now or you're failing. That would be a good thing for them. But I think for most people, you know, obviously that isn't the way I'd present that message, but I think for most people, presenting that vegan message gives them something to aim for. And why not? You know, it's not that you're not saying you're not doing enough, but you're saying, hey, you're moving in this direction. Great job. Keep going. And that's what Casey Topp says. You know, yeah, encouraging them.
Yeah, well, this really resonates with what I've experienced in my street work, is the fact that we've found over the last couple of years that people are coming up to our stall and our events, and they're kind of announcing, really, that they're kind of on the way to veganism, but they're just kind of still on their journey, which I know some people don't like that idea. But the point is, they seem to suggest, well, you know I know where I'm going, it's just that I haven't got there yet. You know, that's kind of like, seems to be what people have in their head, you know, that veganism is a destination.
Exactly. You said it just right. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's very unrealistic for us to think that people just go vegan overnight. Some people do. There were a couple of my focus groups. It was very impressive. I am definitely not one of those people. It took me a long time to transition. And I know that's the case for most people, and all research says that. You know, there's no research that says otherwise. So why would we deny that? You know, when it is, we have to acknowledge a big change culturally, socially, in a lot of ways, in your habits, to suddenly wake up and eat in a completely different way often. You can't just expect people to do that overnight. And if they do try to do it overnight, it might feel too much for them, and they might give up and then become an ex-vegan. And ex-vegans can be sometimes the hardest, because they've already tried and not succeeded. Now they're totally resistant to it. So much better to help them sustain it. And of course, ideally, I would love no animals to be exploited tomorrow. I'd love everyone to be 100% vegan in their lifestyles. But we don't live in a world that supports veganism in the way it supports eating meat, in the way it supports eating animal products. And by recognizing that, we can have empathy for people, and we can say, you're doing a great job. Like, you're moving in this direction. Keep going. How can we help you? What are the things? And one of the things I found, actually, was I found that there were these people who are referred to as near vegans. So they identified as vegan, or they identified as, you know, plant-based or something along those lines. But they had these interesting exceptions, and they were often social in nature. And I found really that the social element is really key, which is kind of the focus of my talk at VegFest. But that, you know, they might, that this discomfort in a social situation, or just thinking, oh, well, I didn't buy it, it's at work, you know, I'll just eat it, it's okay. So I thought that was another really interesting thing. And how do we get people to perhaps drop that last thing, you know, and I refer to this as like a vegan mind shift, where you reach the point where you just think, that's not food, I can't eat that, you know, it's not an option to me. Whereas for others, they may still maintain that idea, well, you know, in this context, I could, or, oh, you know, this isn't so bad, I don't want to make everyone feel uncomfortable. So there's a lot of supports and things I think we can do more there to help people. But that's another thing that I found in terms of, you know, this thing being gradual. And often there's kind of a last thing, or you just can't absorb all the information about the E numbers and all this stuff. And you know, I think pushing people to figure all that out right away can be overwhelming. So I think sometimes that might take a little bit more time. But yeah, like I said, just encouraging forward, I think, is the best way to do it.
I agree with you. I think that that's really good advice. One more piece of advice I'd like to ask from you. With all of the mainstream animal protection groups these days continuing to promote reducitarian advocacy, where do we go from here, given your research?
One thing I've done is I've made a report, and I'm writing blog posts that I'll be sharing with all the nonprofits. I'm in communication with a lot of different nonprofits. I'm also providing like presentations and things. So I'm trying to provide context and information for them, because I think a lot of these organizations are really coming from a really well-meaning place and just trying to do what they think is the right thing. And a lot of times there's just a lot of kind of rampant misinformation, I'd say, within our movement. A lot of really bad research from well-meaning, perhaps, individuals, or, you know, people who just want to make a name for themselves is often what happens. Yes. And just trying to be the voice of this, you know, and that's not my goal. I don't want to say I have all the answers, but I want to say, hey, here's some evidence of something we haven't really looked at in an in-depth way before. And this is suggesting that maybe we need to think more about this. And one of the things I really want to emphasize to nonprofits is the idea of targeted campaigns and thinking more strategically. You know, campaigns seem to just go after the low-hanging fruit, whoever we can get. And I think we're really maxing out on that. So how instead can we actually think more strategically? And in particular, now that veganism is much more common, you know, a lot of these organizations that used to say veg are now saying vegan. I think we're getting more comfortable with it. And we have now this research saying, you know, meat reduction doesn't seem to necessarily work. I think getting them to think, okay, well, what can you actually do with your campaigns? How can you actually promote a vegan goal? And I think there's ways that campaigns could do that really gives people perhaps, you know, like something like a short survey where you get an idea of a few things. And I have a few ideas about things that I think are important, like willingness to cook, I think is a huge one. And having kids, having a family, I think is going to have a huge influence on your life. And that's where you can provide really tailored, useful information. Because like I said, different people are going to need different things. Some people really need to know where convenient food is. I mean, they just need to know how to run into a store, grab some cheap, easy food to feed their family. And for those people, we can't just be telling them, hey, you need to go get jackfruit and you need to make barbecue jackfruit and do this. It's like, I do that, but that would work for me, but that's not going to work for other people. And that's fine. And we need to, you know, recognize that there isn't one size fits all approach. And I think different campaigns now are really, I've talked to people within the movement who say they're concerned that there's this goal that organizations have now of constant growth, right? It's a very like capitalist idea, like we're only successful if we're continuously growing, and there's so much overlap and organizations doing the same thing. So where can some organizations try to be more niche? And I think promoting it in that way, maybe you can get them more on board with the message, like, hey, where can you do something different so that you don't become, you know, irrelevant because you're doing something everyone else is doing? How can you do something different that really tries to get new people involved in our movement and tries to get, you know, the greatest possible change we can, which is, you know, a vegan goal, of course.
Absolutely. And can make our movement perhaps a little bit more diverse as well. I think that's hugely important. Rather than being seen as the animal rights movement, it would be great. If there was much more diversity, I think that would be huge as well. Trent, you co-founded the group London Vegan Voices. Would you please tell us about that group and how the group's helping the community up there?
Yeah, so when I started London Vegan Voices with my partner, we really were just inspired by people like Christopher Sebastian. We both come from a human rights background and we came into animal rights. And for us, it was very much like we saw as an extension of our human rights work, right? So for me, it was like, okay, I understand all these other forms of oppression. Of course, I'm still constantly learning as we all are, but I'm passionate about this. And I've been involved in a lot of different movements. And coming into animal rights, I saw as kind of the end of my not the end of my journey, but like, okay, now it's like I can acknowledge all these different things and really have a holistic approach to understanding the way oppression works. Unfortunately, as others have found as well, within the animal rights movement, most people don't seem to have that background. Most people don't seem to have come in with an understanding or, I guess, desire to look at human oppression in the same way. And there's a lot, you know, my talk last year was about this, about the many ways in which within our movement we have narratives that maintain the idea that we should really only care about the animals, or, you know, that by talking about humans we're distracting from the issue, etc. So you know, we were really interested in how can we start conversations about this and how can we find other people who feel like we do. So not just like, you know, speaking in an echo chamber, but finding people who haven't had these conversations. So especially I find that living in the UK, I find people are much more reluctant to talk about things like race, whereas I, as a white person, you know, have a lot of background in anti-racist work and training, and it's really important to me to acknowledge what it means to be white and what white privilege is. So that's just one, you know, one area of this, but wanting to create a space where these types of conversations can happen. And I ended up through it, we connected with some amazing people like Farah Rainfly, Life After Hummus, who's just incredible. And
we love Farah.
She's amazing.
Absolutely.
What a great person to have in my life. I feel so lucky. But yeah, so it's been fantastic. We've been able to have a lot of great speakers come in, people who I think within many mainstream spaces wouldn't get space, and a lot of discussions and just featuring different things. Like we had business panel for vegan businesses owned by people of color. And it was just, I think, for them to be able to talk with us about like things that they were experiencing within the movement. And for those of us who were there to be able to, I think, understand more about, you know, what it meant to really not just like run a business, but run a business that was vegan and being a person of color in a movement where the mainstream is predominantly seen as quite white and things around that. So, yeah, we were having monthly events, which were going really well. We had to take a bit of a break because as far as doing lots of stuff with her thing, I'm obviously really busy now, having finished the PhD, trying to get this information out there, doing presentations and things. But the group is still going online, and people are very welcome to find us on Facebook. And we're hoping to start up the events again soon. But what we like about it is it's a great space for people to come to, I think, who have these questions and have a place for these conversations. You know, there are so few pro-intersectional type of vegan spaces. I mean, they just don't really exist anymore. And the ones that exist on Facebook often end up falling apart. And we're so proud that of the people who've come to us and, you know, been a part of this group. And I think shared valuable resources, people have been willing to share their experiences. And I just feel, I feel so honored to have met the people I've met through it. And I'm so glad that we have this space for people to go through, to go to and just feel like they can talk about things and just start questioning things and acknowledging problems within our movement. Because I think, you know, a lot of times people, like I said, who are really well-intentioned just don't have the knowledge or haven't had the conversation or don't understand where there's a problem. But then again, there's also these kind of celebrity culture that's just getting worse and worse, where we have a lot of white men who suddenly get famous and now are on Patreon making a ton of money, like a ton of money. And I'm just like, what are they doing? You know? So I think we need to think differently about who our leaders are within our movement. Like people like Brenda Sanders, to me, it doesn't get much better than that. You know, she is doing absolutely incredible, incredible work. And yet most people don't know who she is. She's not out there trying to make a name for herself. She's literally just trying to make the world a better place for people and animals. And, you know, and those are the type of people we should be looking to, not the ones trying to be famous, who often have no background in anything other than working for an organization for a bit or something. But
Not even that. And are often actually proud of the fact that they have no background or education.
Yeah.
And I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, and they're pretty much always white men. I mean, that's the thing. Yes. We don't even question it. You know,
Hey, Carolyn, I think we found the person behind Ken Saviour here.
No, I wish. No, I mean, it's just, it's incredible. And people, I really would love someone to look into more is the people giving the money, because they're getting so much money now. These very few individuals, it's not really clear what they're doing with it. Why do we think that's the best way to help animals? I don't understand. Please, can someone out there who's listening do something to find out what's going on there? And can we change it?
This is actually a huge problem, and it's a really serious problem, because the type of people who are being drawn into the movement are the type of people who are being attracted by the saviors. And so it's getting worse, because we're attracting more and more of the type of people who want to throw money at the saviors and who want to support them, and who, like you say, don't know who Brenda Sanders is. And it makes me very sad, and it makes me very disappointed to see this happening to the movement.
Yeah, I completely agree. It obviously says something about the world we live in today, where we have these, what's it called, influencers, or whatever they are. And that's the way things work. And even with my research, I've had to, use Instagram, because that's the only way to get people to listen. But at the same time, I think it's hard, I think I for me, and this is one of the things I always try to talk with people about, and I know this was the focus of my talk last year, is the role that privilege plays in my life. And as someone who presents as a white male, I'm given a lot of space and I'm given a lot of authority often. I mean, now I have a PhD, so at least I have something I can talk about where I'm like, well, I did do something, so hopefully I know something about this. But I found that, you know, even before that in my life, I recognize that that's the way privilege works. And that's the way it works in our movement. And if we don't question it, this is just going to get worse and worse because we have amazing people who we're just not listening to, and they're struggling to get any money or to get any support. And then there are these people who just come in and we will give them all the money they want. And we don't know what they're doing with it. No one really cares. But
exactly. There's no accountability at all.
Yeah. And the patron, I mean, you can get rid of how much money you're making. If I was donating to someone on there and it doesn't say how much money they're making, I don't understand. Stop giving the money. They could be making any amount of money. We don't know what they're doing with it. There's no question that that's not the best way to help the animals, because you're just giving one person money to do whatever they want with it.
Giving one person, like they're giving, say, for example, a white male who, say, for example, lives in Brisbane, because that's where I live. So I use that as an example. They're giving that one white man money to travel to London or to different exotic locations to do advocacy in those places, where the people who live in those places are just every bit as capable of doing what he's being paid to travel and do. If someone was coming from a different country to Brisbane to do advocacy, I would find it somewhat insulting, because we're quite capable of doing the type of advocacy ourselves here in Brisbane that anyone else could come in and do. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and that's really links to, I think, the kind of colonialism we still see within the animal movement. And I went to a conference in Nepal called Animals for Asia a couple years ago, and it was the first time I'd been to Asia, and I was like, I couldn't believe they wanted me to speak. I was really excited. I was like, okay, this is gonna be great. But what I was really surprised by is that I found that people not from anywhere in Asia were the ones being given the most space to talk about animals in Asia and what they need and the work they're doing. And I think it's such a phenomenon we see within our movement of, you know, it's kind of like this white savior complex, right? Of people from the UK or from the US going to, say, China and saving the animals there. And it doesn't make sense in any way when we have those problems in our own backyard, you know.
Exactly.
And when we, if we really want to change things in other places, we should be supporting people there, people from that area to do it, because they'll know more what's actually needed. So it's all very linked, and I would love it if, you know, this kind of more intersectional lens can start really catching on more. And I'm glad to see that people like Christopher Sebastian are getting so much more, I think, attention and space. I hope that people are starting to open their eyes to the ways that these things connect. And really that, you know, when it comes down to it, from a purely any kind of selfish perspective or perspective of only caring about animals, you're going to do a better job if you think about the human side of things. You really can't change these systems if you forget about all the ways that the ways that animals are treated are linked to the ways that humans are treated.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Trent, we'll put a link to your Facebook group and also to your research on the post when we publish the podcast. I know the research isn't fully available yet, but we'll put a link to your blog post where you're putting out little bits and pieces of it.
Great. I'm actually putting out the final report on Monday. It's totally done. So this is I have, you know, a 300 plus page dissertation. I'm not expecting anybody to read that. So that's why I've made this report. That's much more easy to read and a lot shorter.
I'll read it.
Yeah.
I'll read it.
Oh, you really like what is that? But hopefully the 20 page report, it covers most things and most of the things that I think advocates will care about. So I can just send you that link now or when we get off the phone. And because the link is live, it's just I'm sharing it on Monday.
Okay, that would be perfect. Trent, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I've thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you for the research that you're doing. Good luck at VegFest. And thank you for everything that you've been doing for both humans and other animals. It's really appreciated.
Oh, thank you so much. No, this has been really interesting. It's been the animal kingdom. Nurses past maturity. No member of the animal kingdom ever did a thing to me. So I don't need red meat or white.